This is a download from BFM 89.9, the business station.
Good afternoon and welcome to Live and Learn on The Bigger Picture. I am Lau Yau Hua. To propel Malaysia's economy to the next stage, our nation needs more scientists and engineers, and very good ones too. Why? Just think of the wheel, paper, antibiotics, steam engine, electricity and the computer. Scientists, engineers and inventors have always accelerated social and economic revolutions. Yet as countries like Korea, Taiwan and Singapore surge ahead to challenge Western countries in science and technology, Malaysia continues to hang on the lower rungs of international assessments of science and mathematics. To get a better idea of what makes scientific excellence and how to educate for it, I spoke to Sir Dr. Tim Han, the winner of the 2001 Nobel Prize in Physiology or Medicine. Dr. Han shares the prize with Sir Paul Nurse and Dr. Leland Hartwell for their discovery of proteins that regulate how our cells divide. Dr. Hunt and I chatted in a cafe in Seoul, Korea, where the 2015 World Conference of Science Journalists was held in early June. Now, hours after this interview, Dr. Han commented on women in labs. His comments were widely interpreted as sexist and sparked severe social media backlash. Days after, Dr. Hunt resigned from University College London and the European Research Council. He said he was forced to do so. Since then, Dr. Hunt has apologized for what he described as an inexcusable remark. At the time this show is aired, the debate on Dr. Hunt's remarks and the reaction to it continues, as more scientists express support for Dr. Hunt. I would say that the best proof of character would be what a person has done for years, but not what he has said once. So let's start with, you know, scientific progress. We marvel at every disruptive scientific progress that scientists have made, but I wonder if, you know, for every transformative scientific progress or discovery there is, there are many others that leave the general layman wondering, oh man, what has that to do with me? Do you think that kind of thought, you know, wondering what were the scientists doing, spending all that time, questioning that, is that valid or is it just an ignorance on the part of that person walking on the street?
Well, I think it's a difficult thing for the general public to understand what scientists really do. And most of what we do is very boring. I mean, we just pipette things from one tube to another and we worry about little tiny things. And that's the nature of the game. Of course, I can't speak for the really transformative things. I mean, which I would say were exactly as you said, the incredible rise of communications, the incredible development of computing power, which is a wonderful mixture of, very advanced physics and very clever people writing the programs and the operating systems and all that stuff. And as a biologist, I do something which is much more mundane, much more down to earth. And, I like to tell people that all I do is study frog eggs, which is pretty much true. And, why would anyone want to know about frog eggs, you might well ask? And why should we support this guy only studying frog eggs? What do frog eggs have to do with anything? But the answer is that actually there's a point to studying frog eggs because they have two advantages. One, when they're fertilized, they start dividing rapidly. And one general rule of biology is if you want to study something, find a place where it happens a lot. And the second of all is that frog eggs are so big is that they're very easy to break. They're very fragile so that you can get the insides out just by spinning them hard. Just putting them in a washing machine would do do the trick. And once you've taken them out from inside the cell membranes, you can then add things, subtract things, manipulate them in all kinds of ways very, very easily and find out how the cell division machinery works. And that's what I spent the last 20 years or so of my life doing. And it was good fun.
So, Doctor, do you think there are questions in science that is not worth asking? Are there scientific investigations that you think are not even worth starting?
I would say no. I think everything is worth investigating because you never know when you're going to make a discovery. And one of the points that I really would like to emphasize is that discoveries have to be unexpected. If you already knew how the world worked, there would be no point in investigating it any further because you would know the result of every experiment. But what actually happens in scientific investigations is that you never quite know what is going to happen. And sometimes you get a big surprise. I mean, like when I discovered my disappearing protein, people would have said it was impossible that a protein could disappear like that. And indeed, it was many, many years before the mechanism of its disappearance and the control of its disappearance was understood, and there are still aspects that we don't understand today. But, I mean, this is fundamental to understanding the way cells divide, and cell division is probably one of the most fundamental processes of all of life. We'd none of us be here. We contain something like 50 generations, each one of us, which is an astronomical number of cells. I mean, you know, it's of the order of 10 to the 14th cells. That's a lot of cells. And to get there, they all have to divide from one fertilized egg. So, you know, this is something well worth understanding, and the control of it, and, you know. And so you do proceed by little tiny steps, and if you try to take big steps, you will always fall flat on your face. I learned that at quite an early age as a graduate student. I tried to design experiments that were too ambitious, and when I did that, they always didn't work. So I learned that doing little experiments on Saturday mornings was a much better way of proceeding. But if anyone had watched me saying, "What are you doing now?" They would probably have said, "What a waste of time, you know. That's such a stupid little question. You know, why don't you tackle something more important?" But the answer is that you have to break it down. That's one of the skills of the researcher, that you have to learn. It takes a long time in biology to learn that, how to break a big problem down into its component parts so that you can be really sure. I mean, so that every time you take a step, the next step is really your back foot is really firmly planted on the ground. If it isn't, then you will fall on your nose.
It's you said that discoveries, you know, are unexpected and they have to be, but don't you think that's a bit discouraging for the, I guess, young and aspiring scientists to say that, you know, you can't really expect it. It may come, maybe not randomly, but it may never come to you. And for the scientists out there who are like, you know, or for the young people out there listening, I want to be a great scientist one day and to have great discoveries and, you know, perhaps even to win the Nobel Prize. But you're saying that, you know, don't aim for that. Is there
definitely, definitely don't aim for that. That's a disaster. You mustn't aim for that. But you must aim, I think, to have fun. A very talented friend of mine said, and it's true, I mean, we talk about tasting blood. If you make a discovery, and my observation is that young scientists, the better they are, the quicker they make a really important discovery. And once you've tasted the joy of making a discovery, it's terribly addictive. It's probably even more addictive than sex. It's extraordinary, you know, that you're the first person in the world to understand something. It might only be a little thing to start with, but then, you know, little things build and become bigger. So it's really, really important that. And it's not discouraging at all. I mean, I think it doesn't matter what you discover, but something that you have ownership of. And that's why people care so much about questions of priority. Were you really the first person to see this or not? Because it's I suppose, you know, this is what drives property speculators. You know, they built this whole shopping center. I've never experienced that kind of joy, but I think it must be the same, you know, or I wrote this very successful book. Everything, you know, it's yours and only yours, and you know, you can celebrate that success. So that's what drives people forward. It's just satisfying their curiosity, and then it's also a matter of pride to be able to tell your peers that you've done something, you know, that you understand something that they don't. That's very important. I really think we were discussing this the other day, and I think it's sort of curiosity, boastfulness, and competition. You know, you also, like in any competition, it's best to be first and not second.
Another Nobel Prize winner, the Austrian physicist Erwin Schrödinger, he once said that science is a game, but one with reality. Do you agree with that?
I completely, yes. I mean, I think any scientist has to be has to have a playful aspect to what they're doing. Of course, it's very, very serious because you are trying, you are asking nature. And that's where the reality comes in, too. I mean, it's no good speculating. You have to test your ideas to see whether they actually correspond to how the way the world works. So, and that's what makes science so exceptionally powerful, because if you can't reproduce my results when I tell you how to do it, then they're probably not true. I've probably made a mistake. So that sort of public correction of error is a really powerful means of keeping people on the right track. And that's why there are certain qualities, values in science, I think, which are extremely important. And this sort of ruthless pursuit of the truth, the integrity of science, is tremendously important at the core of it. So have fun, enjoy yourself, play at the margins, but always check.
So if science is a game, and every game, a game can't be a game if there are no rules then. And so what are the rules in science then?
What are the rules in science? I never really thought about that question, actually. I mean, I think the rules are simply that you have to be honest. That's perhaps the only rule.
And you mentioned fun, you know, that is great for... It's not just great, it's in fact crucial for scientists to have fun, you know, for science to be a very a fun-filled endeavor. Is Nobel Prize then the ultimate fun?
No, I wouldn't say so at all, actually. I mean, when I was told that I had been awarded the Nobel Prize, it was like, it was awful, actually, because it singles you out unfairly from your peers, and in the case of the Medicine Prize, they do celebrate these acts of discoveries, which, as I say, are really matters of mainly of pure luck. I mean, that's not quite true, because you have to recognize the luck. You have to be sort of on the lookout for something, I think, to really realize when you've made a great discovery. So perhaps there's some skill and judgment involved as well. But it's mostly luck. At least that's the way I felt it. And it hardly seems right to reward luck with a gigantic prize. I mean, it's like winning the lottery. And so where's the sense in that? And it projects you, propels you into a completely different world of more sort of political kind of a world. I mean, everybody treats you with now exaggerated respect, but you're still the same old idiot that you were when you started out.
Yeah, I think you're overly humble. I mean...
I don't think so. This is just reality. I mean, as I say, If you get obsessed with your own greatness, I think that's when pride comes before a fall. So watch out.
That was Sir Dr. Tim Han, Nobel laureate in physiology or medicine for 2001, sharing his passion for science and describing it as a fun game. Up next, I ask Dr. Hunt what does it take for scientists to score breakthroughs and how we can nurture such talents. BFM 89.9. Good afternoon and welcome to Live and Learn on the Bigger Picture. I am Lau Yaohua. We continue our examination into the makings of scientific excellence with Sir Dr. Tim Hunt, Nobel laureate in physiology or medicine for 2001. As I resume my conversation with Dr. Hunt over coffee, I ask for his thoughts on collaborations in science projects, which in my experience can sometimes turn into a drag and sap away the excitement of research.
Well, I guess I've been happiest when in collaborations, but the collaborations would be within the lab for the most part. I mean, it would be me, undergraduate student, me and a post, and usually with only a very small group. I mean, that is to say, perhaps four people, five people at the maximum, and really sort of one or two people. Mm-hmm. And I think that's important. I don't think you could, certainly for what I do, I couldn't do it all by myself. Just not good enough. And then different people bring different skills and strengths and weaknesses to the table. Some people are very good at details, and sometimes you need details. Some people are better at the broader picture, and sometimes you need the broader picture. And somebody's very good at some technique but not so good at another. That's that kind of thing. I don't, a lot of people now say, well, we need big data, so we need enormous teams. And I could never understand how you would manage an enormous team. And it seems like the contribution of any one member of such a team would be really rather minor. So, as I say, I was really happy with pursuing a little problem just with one or two other people. That's really good fun.
Talking about scientific research and the work that needs to be done, do you think that creativity is really a key force in driving significant scientific discoveries?
No, I think creativity is very, very important. And I'm not sure creativity is the right word. I think it is that element of playfulness, the willingness to explore the boundaries and to it's very serious, but you have to temper that seriousness with a little humour and lightness. And often, you know, people do their best work when they're sort of fooling around, playing, just examining the wilder margins of their subject. And I think many people today are much too focused. I mean, one of the problems about big grants, and quite a lot of people get really seriously big grants, is that they bring a heavy responsibility. And I think that heavy responsibility itself tends to stifle the creative playfulness that I like to see. Because, you know, you can't say... It's sort of difficult to say to a taxpayer, you know, I'm being paid to have a good time, but that's basically what it is. And I must say that probably my most important discoveries were made when I had very little research support. I mean, somebody paid my salary, but I wasn't paid very much, and so I was free to do exactly as I pleased. And if you're not free to do exactly as you're pleased, then I think you're sort of working with your hands tied behind your back to some extent. I may be wrong about that, and there are times when you just need to forge forward and do what needs to be done. I'm not so good at that, I think. I prefer the more exploratory things. So, I mean, science is a very broad church. I mean, there are a lot of different kinds of people and different... They bring different skills to bear on problems at different times. And I think it's just like, I mean, one is told when companies are set up, the founders often make very bad managers later on when the thing is established. So you need a sort of different quality of skills early and late in projects. And science is no different. I mean, I think what people often don't understand is what a human activity science is. I mean, that petty jealousies and whether you like somebody or you dislike them, whether you're irritated by the shape of their nose or something, you know, that dirty habits, you know, that can be very destructive. And my experience has been when things are going well, it's almost like it's a quite intense love affair. You know, it's really, those qualities infect the science and drive it to some degree.
Wow, even the shape of the nose. Huh?
the shape of the nose is perhaps going a bit too far, but I have seen, you know, that happy labs can suddenly be poisoned when some new person who doesn't fit into the group comes. And it's often very hard to diagnose. You can't quite understand why it is that things aren't working the way they used to. I've known that experience.
You mentioned that discoveries are made when one is free to explore the wilder margins, you know, not conform to any one set, maybe paradigm or set rules of, you know, which direction to go. I think that's one of the crux of the problems in that the management wants accountability. They want to evaluate the staff. And so to do that, you know, now we're talking about quantification of performance. So we have things like KPIs, key performance indexes. And I think maybe for the management, it's easier to explain to their bosses, also easier to explain to stakeholders, you know, why we are keeping this staff on and that kind of stuff. But, I mean, for a graduate student or for his or her supervisor to conform to that, to meet those targets, they have no choice but to produce something tangible, right? And not take the risk of exploring something less certain, something risky, instead of taking the safer path. What's your take on that? Do you think that's really a poison, and what can we do about it?
No, I completely agree. I think you put that very well, actually. I mean, it really is poisonous, all this accountability, very antithetical to what I would like to see. But I also see it from the other point of view. I mean, of course you want to know whether you're spending the money wisely, and the secret is in success. But the trouble is that success, real success, I mean big spectacular success, comes few and far between. So maybe it is important to make sure that everybody is actually going into the lab every day. But, you know, I mean, we had one project I was involved with not so long ago actually insisted that, you know, you took timesheets. I mean, because you'd promised to work 50% of your time. So the poor old postdoc who was working themselves to the bone had to fill out these wretched timesheets. And, he must have wildly exceeded the time that he was... because he was constantly, you know, morning, noon and night, his poor family. But that kind of accountability is absolutely pointless and futile, and it distracts from the real issue. I mean, so in truth, a tremendous amount of trust is involved in these kinds of things, and granting bodies and large agencies are not very good at trust. They tend to be untrusting, and that's a big problem. And then, in terms of the key performance indicators, you can tell when you go into a successful lab. You don't need a key performance indicator to tell when things are going well. You can just see that people are motivated and busy, and the lab is crowded. And I went round a lab not so long ago, and it was full of machines, but there was nobody running the machines, and they were very proud of this wide variety of machines they had, but I could see that there weren't enough people there. I like to see people tripping over each other, you know, with excitement and busyness, and that's how you really tell. And you can also tell when people talk about what they're doing. You know, it's immediately obvious if they're really doing good stuff, because you can kind of easily understand it. You can understand their motivation, and you can understand why they did what they did, and in order to get where they're going, and you can sort of also see what their aims and aspirations are for their work. Whereas, you know, other people who are much more conformist to the rules and probably producing great KPIs, you know, it's just terribly boring. But the logic is impeccable. I mean, you know, you can't fight it, because, you know, here we are giving all this public money, and I don't know. But on the other hand, we're sort of used to that kind of thing in one sphere. I mean, you know, that you pay good money to go to the theatre, you pay good money to go to the movies, you pay good money to go and watch a football match, you know, and there you're actually just paying people to perform creatively. Why shouldn't scientists be the same? But the trouble is, you know, it's, yeah, I don't know how it wouldn't be a very good spectator sport, that's for sure.
I think one of the issues, and one that many people fail to or struggle to understand, is that scientific discovery or scientific progress is not linear. It's not really linear. It's like, I guess it's like a ladder. You know, you can go stagnant go flat for a certain.
Yeah, it can be. You know, you can suffer long periods where absolutely nothing happens, and then suddenly, whoosh, you make a great breakthrough. And but the fog always descends in the end. Actually, it's quite interesting. I think one of the other problems today is, at least in my field, I mean, we've made such spectacular progress since I was a graduate student. That at the beginning, you know, almost any question you asked would have an interesting answer. I mean, there were a lot of stones to turn over, and almost every stone had something interesting underneath it when you turned it over. Now, I think, you know, we're much more, I feel that the basis is much better established, so it's much harder to find a place where you can be profitably employed. I mean, there are places where, you know, we still understand the control of cell growth very, very imperfectly, and it's perfectly clear that it's very complicated, which it has to be, because it has to be very robust, and that means teasing it apart and finding out how it works is difficult. But, you know, lots of simple questions have already been answered, so it's a little bit tough for a beginner to get into some of these fields. It's so bloody complicated. I mean, I certainly can't understand most of it. I just don't have the stamina anymore to read all those reviews and really get my head around the concepts. I like being in on the beginning of things where not much is known and don't have to read too much.
That courage and spirit of daring to experiment, to try, you know, to not be afraid of failure, I think that's an attitude that has to be nurtured right from the beginning, from young. And so to have great scientists that we can trust without having to impose all the KPIs, we will need to train them from young, I guess. So what's your take on a good education to make a to make a good scientist?
It is like an apprenticeship, and the only thing I would say is that on the whole, you know, it takes a good scientist to breed a good scientist. You need to develop these habits of, serious inquiry, how to do experiments. I mean, I found, interestingly, it was very difficult for beginners to understand the idea of the control experiment, which is, and there are two kinds of controls, positive controls and negative controls. And if you don't include controls in all your experiments, then you never find anything out. So that's a sort of idiotic basic lesson. But you'd be surprised how many people don't get it. I mean, how often you come up with the answer, oh, I did that control last Thursday. No. Control is built into every single experiment, not something you only do once and then never have to do again. And then there's the learning, you know, that actually what is possible and what is not possible and what is theoretically, you know, being able and studying things that are really difficult but important. And I think you're right that, you know, too many people it's easy to take too small steps. But you equally well fail if you take too large steps. So judging the step size is something which is quite difficult and terribly, terribly important.
Any advice on how we can nurture the attitude to experiment and the courage to fail?
Yeah, I don't know how you do that. I mean, I think, oh, gosh.
Well, with the students that you have mentored, or even with your children, Do you nurture such spirits and such attitudes?
Well, I'm disappointed. I have two daughters, who neither of whom are scientists, and I can well understand why they're not scientists, because in the UK now, a science education isn't really an education. It's just learning a list of facts you have to know, and you have to know what the right answer is, and you have to know how many points you get for this bit of the answer and that bit of the answer, and this isn't science, or it isn't anything actually. It's just a kind of memory test. You might as well ask them to remember random lists of things, as far as I could tell. And most of the questions, oh boy. So it's just totally boring and not interesting. And that comes actually from this accountability. I mean, you want to find out whether the students are actually benefiting from teaching. Well, that's not what you want to find out. You want to find out whether they're having a good time. And it's very difficult to find out if they're actually learning anything, because if they're learning something, they're probably having fun. And if they're not having fun, they're really not learning anything. So it's hard.
So before we wrap up the show, let's end with a hypothetical question. So if you were given the ability to design a science education and a research framework for a whole community from scratch, how would you do it? Paint us the picture.
Well, I think there's only one way to hand out money, and that's to people with a good track record. In the ERC, again, we do it by 50% track record of the applicant, 50% for the project they propose, and that's a sort of pretty good rule of thumb. I mean, then people say, oh, well, you know, that means we won't get so many of this kind of person, and we should have it 60-40 rather than 50-50. But I think that's sort of tinkering at the margin. I think one of the big problems is administering grants. It costs the same to administer a very large grant as a small grant, because in terms of, you know, writing contracts and making sure that people get the money, making sure that they spend the money properly and so on and so forth. And I think many of the grants that are given out are actually too big, and it would be much better to have small little grants that you could apply for. I really like small project grants rather than great big program grants. We did very well out of them. And that's something that's difficult to do, apparently, from a purely administrative point of view. So when I was designing my brilliant grant, I would make sure that there were sort of clever small grant schemes. And I don't know how you do that, because I'm not a bureaucrat or administrator, unfortunately. If I knew, I would say.
Any key messages that you'd like to leave us with on scientific discoveries and nurturing scientists that can solve problems for society?
Well, I always tell people, you know, keep your feet on the ground but your eyes on the horizon, and work hard.
Wise words. Right, thank you for speaking to us, Doctor.
That was Sir Dr. Tim Hunt, joint winner of the Nobel Prize in Physiology or Medicine for 2001, sharing his thoughts on nurturing scientific excellence with me in Seoul, where we both attended the World Conference of Science Journalists. I am Lau Yaohua, and you have been listening to Live and Learn, BFM 89.9.
Thank you for listening to this podcast. To find more great interviews, go to bfm.my or find us on iTunes. BFM 89.9, the business station.